Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of More from Sam. Sam, how's it going?
Good, good. How are you doing?
I am good. I'm good. We had dinner last night, but I still have to ask you how you're doing.
Yeah. Well, things could have changed in the meantime.
That's true. As a reminder to all, the goal of this series is to get more from Sam on current events more often. I'm here to surface Sam's ideas, and we'll be doing so, as always, with the input of subscribers, questions, and comments. Thank you guys for taking the time to share those with us. And lastly, this series is not meant to be a replacement for anything. It's simply in addition to what Sam is already doing. So if you don't enjoy it, don't worry. It's fine. One more thing before we get started, some updates on Sam's upcoming tour. There are currently 5 shows on sale at the moment: New York, Boston, Seattle, San Jose, and Chicago. I believe all those shows still have some tickets still available, although in some markets, I think that number is pretty low. So if you want to see the show, you can head over to Ticketmaster, search Sam Harris, or you can find the dates listed at samharris.org. Also, it seems likely that we're going to be adding some dates in the future, so be on the lookout for those. I'm thinking maybe LA, maybe Texas somewhere. I don't know. If you have any suggestions, please make those suggestions and we'll consider those. As a reminder, Sam will be delivering a prepared talk for the first part, and then he and I will sit down and do a version of this, more from Sam, in the second segment. While Sam will offer some disturbing insights, it will also be hopeful. Is that right, Sam?
I hope so. Yeah, a lot can happen between now and then.
Yeah, well, it's a night out. So regardless of the topics, it's important that you all enjoy yourselves too. So we'll do our best to make sure that happens. Okay, let's get to our first topic. And with a little fun, did you see the latest on Epstein? The DOJ and FBI have concluded that Epstein had no client list.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. Pam Bondi said she had the list on her desk, I think. And now she says there is no list. So you MAGA people reconcile those irreconcilable notions. I mean, does anyone care? Do they care that they're lied to now about something that was their dearly held, bright, shiny object for so many years? I mean they've got to be lying one way or the other, right? There's just no way that both these claims can be true. So,
I mean, so this was a big one. I mean, a lot of people were electing Trump, right? Just that we couldn't wait to open up that that Christmas present.
Well, yeah, we want to know about the UFOs. We want to know about JFK. We want to know about what else was on that list, but certainly Epstein was at the top of that list.
And yeah. Well, speaking of the UFO, didn't we see something that the Pentagon did? I mean, that was pretty crazy.
That was crazy. It sounded like it was a hazing ritual among Pentagon employees.
That's pretty fucked up. That went on for like decades.
Yeah, that misfired badly.
Yeah, not good.
But it's an easier explanation than that we're actually being visited by extraterrestrials. And they're abducting us and performing amateur proctology on people in the middle of the country.
And yet the cameras, what's that line that they say? Well, the cameras continue to improve. The sightings are always still at one megapixel.
It's always a looks like a frisbee covered with tinfoil thrown in the air.
One seems to be able to capture it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to we just celebrated July 4th, and for all our flaws, we really are an amazing country. And one of the enduring paradoxes of democracy is that it extends rights and protections even to those who would use them to undermine it. We see this in various forms: Islamists who leverage free speech and open borders to advance illiberal aims, and elements on the right that manipulate loopholes and procedural gray zones to violate ethical standards and concentrate power. The central challenge is how to defend democracy against those who would hollow it out from within without compromising the liberal principles that define it. How do we build safeguards robust enough to protect democracy, yet restrained enough not to destroy it in the process?
Well, that really is the $64 trillion question at this point. I mean, we have this tension in open societies. I prefer the framing of open society more than democracy. I mean, I think it's, in the Venn diagram of political and social institutions, those overlap significantly. But I think Popper's notion of an open society is the more important one to defend here. And it's a society in which the institutions allow for error correction because, I mean, the institutions, both governmental and non-governmental, allow for error correction because things like free speech and pluralistic tolerance are enshrined as into law and into norms, right? So you can talk about more or less anything. You can argue over more or less anything. It's not a theocracy. It's not an authoritarian dictatorship. It's not a much less a totalitarian one. It's not some, tribal fiefdom in Afghanistan, right? It's just, it's the society we know and love and have imperfectly built for ourselves here in the West, but the open societies are perpetually under threat by people who would use the principles of tolerance to undermine tolerance. And one of the most glaring examples of this in recent times is the kind of the stealth and none too stealthy Islamist campaigning everywhere, which is basically trying to smuggle in theocracy into Western communities. And the liberals, the erstwhile liberals, the left wing of every left wing party, it has been successfully gulled by this, or has just not been actually deceived, but just for other reasons decided to make common cause with Islamists. And so this has been supercharged by the war in Gaza of late, and the nascent or endemic anti-Semitism on the left and in the Muslim community. So yeah, it's what to do about it is there's no easy answer to that. I mean, we can't tip over into xenophobia and bigotry. We have to focus on dangerous ideas rather than specific classes of people. But in broad strokes, it's certainly tempting to notice that specific classes of people have more than their share of dangerous ideas, right? So when you have a regime like the second Trump administration or some of the right wing parties in Western Europe wanting to filter by Muslims or immigrants from specific countries, Muslim majority countries, it's easy to see why that's tempting. I don't agree with any of that, but the underlying concern is something I'm also very much worried about, which is the spread of Islamism and jihadism in the West.
So if you don't agree with that, how do you solve that problem? So if you can't say, okay, we're going to try to keep anybody out of the country who's going to use democracy or
well, we should do that
against it, right? So how do you do that?
We should vet people. We just shouldn't say we're going to keep everyone from Somalia out of the country or everyone from Eritrea or Saudi Arabia or just pick your country.
But how do you find out if somebody's more religious or less religious? So you say, well, take people from every country.
I mean, there has to be some process of vetting. I mean, we have to screen people. We have to talk to people. We have to do online research about people. I mean, they have to have references. I'm not into the weeds on what the process actually is, but clearly there's some process that's possible whereby we could raise the probability of successfully catching jihadists and Islamists who are trying to immigrate. And we have to acknowledge that we want to do that. Just as we wouldn't want to import Nazis into our society, we should not be eager to import Islamists and jihadists into our society.
Right. So where do you draw the line with, and I'm blanking on his name, from Colombia, who was tossed out and then brought back, where do you draw the line with someone like him?
Khalil, I think his name was.
That's right. Mahmoud Khalil. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we should acknowledge it's different once someone has been admitted and been given a green card, right? Then there's a different burden of proof, and there's got to be a different procedure, right? So it's better to keep people out rather than let them in and then figure out how to respond to the fact that they're in now legally. But yeah, I mean, if someone is sufficiently despicable, I think we should be able to rescind their green card and kick them out of the country. I mean, it's not the same thing as you're not a citizen if you have a green card. And, ultimately we have to figure out what to do with citizens who go bonkers and believe these things, right? I mean, this is, that's under the rubric of free speech and freedom of religion, but we have a problem with potentially homegrown jihadists. This is a problem that's easy to forget about given all the other problems in the world. But the moment we have another terrorist attack in the society of any scale, all of a sudden we're going to realize this problem never went away. It's a bigger problem in Western Europe than it is in America, but it's a problem here too. Again, we have to err on the side of tolerating the expression of any ideas, right? I don't think we should be kicking people out for saying despicable things. But the moment they do more than merely talk about them, the moment they're planning to do something, the moment they're physically obstructing life on a university campus, keeping Jews out of certain buildings or bullying them physically, right? Spitting in people's faces who are trying to attend lectures. All those kinds of things have happened on college campuses. All of that's illegal, right? All of that should get you kicked out of, I mean, it should get you prosecuted, but it should also get you, it's all assault, but it should also get you kicked out of school, right? These people shouldn't be, winning awards for social activism. They should be kicked out of these Ivy League universities for behaving badly.
Topic: the new ecosystem of independent media personalities seems really no different from what we're seeing in politics. Mamdani, for example, is basically an influencer, just happens to be running for mayor. Meanwhile, Tucker Carlson is interviewing the president of Iran. The gatekeepers are gone, and in many ways, maybe we're better off for it. But in what ways are we worse? And why do you think it feels like only populists are able to gain traction now?
Well, so populism is a few things, but at its core, it's a rejection of elites and elite institutions, right? It's an expression of resentment and revulsion against the gatekeepers. So it almost has built into its DNA an abdication of the kinds of standards and notions of responsibility that those gatekeepers and institutions imperfectly embodied, right? You have just lots of people out there with iPhones pretending to be journalists. And you know, one of them is effectively Tucker Carlson, right? Like he's got more than an iPhone, but basically he has the principles of somebody just wielding an iPhone with impunity and with no reputation for professionalism or integrity to protect. So, and you could add a lot of people to that list, but so all of these sort of outdoor cats who are now gaining audiences of tens of millions of people are, I mean, it's entertaining, right? They're in the entertainment business, right? A lot of these people are very good at what they do. I mean, I think Tucker is extremely good at what he does. So is Candace Owens, right? I mean, these are people who have charisma and they're very facile demagogues and confabulators and conspiracists. And again, they don't feel the friction of personal integrity, or at least it's not apparent to me that they ever have. So they can just lie and spin, and but there's no burden of not being a hypocrite. I mean, that's not a fate to be avoided, because it's not a fate that is even acknowledged when you don't have any principles. So they're just kind of freewheeling bullshitters who can keep tacking left and right and up and down as their whims strike. And then this is also Trump is an animal of this kind. There's no burden of coherence. There's no burden of paying attention to what really happened in the world, or the risks of spreading certain lies. I mean, it's entertainment, you know, and on some level, we're entertaining ourselves toward the precipice.
Yeah, I mean, if everyone is rejecting the system and everyone becomes outdoor cats, at some point, there's nobody left in the building. And when you map that onto the political sector, and you see someone like a Mamdani, who is falling in the footsteps of an AOC or a Bernie, and on the right, you have, as you said, Trump, it just seems like these are the only people that can get traction here. And so is this what the future looks like for everyone? Is that everyone is rejecting the system and saying, hey, I'm not with those guys. And at some point, everybody, it's sort of every man for themselves.
Well, clearly we need institutions, and I mean, we have institutions and they're still functioning. It's just on the government side, I mean, certainly in Trump's second administration, they're being increasingly populated by loyalists and cranks and loons and grifters and incompetents, right? I mean, so the kinds of people who are running the Justice Department or the FBI or HHS, I mean, these are not the sober experts who you would want, even if you agreed that you had to purge all the old experts who gave us a bad response to COVID or a bad response to foreign policy or anything else, right? Even if you think literally everyone in the Biden administration was corrupt and incompetent, and you needed a new crop of people, you still want sober experts who are not grifting lunatics, right? You know, who have their own, you have dollar signs in the self-branded logo of their name, and who are just creatures who came from the tabloids and now have responsibility for law and order in our society. So we need institutions that we can trust. And the question is, what will make them trustworthy again? And some, I think, are trustworthy most of the time, even though their reputations have been badly damaged by just the backlash against them and their own failures in recent years. And I think it's very easy to exaggerate how bad the New York Times is, or Harvard University is, or the government is, right? I mean, I think a lot of that's been exaggerated, but I understand everyone's frustration with institutions in the last few years. And we have a degree of transparency coupled with a degree of misinformation that has created a kind of perfect storm of reputational damage for the gatekeepers and the experts, right? So like half of the stuff speaking very broadly, half of the stuff is true and embarrassing and worth correcting. The other half is, you know, Alex Jones style confabulation and lies. But both halves are in most people's brains, or at least right of center in America now. And the left of center has its own problems. But
what just problems with institutions? I mean, I'm going to try again to get you to talk about Mamdani. I mean, if you're growing up in America today where the deck feels more stacked than ever, you know, where's your incentive to defend capitalism? You know, what do you say to the people in New York City that say, fuck you, you know, it hasn't worked for me, regardless of how bad socialism has been proven to be disastrous in the past? Capitalism isn't working, so we'll just try something else or bring everyone else down. So, you know, is Mamdani, are we going to see more of this in the future, more of these types?
Well, I have been arguing for a very long time. I mean, maybe close to two decades, that we have a real and growing problem with wealth inequality in this country. And obviously, Mamdani is responding to that. I mean, you know, it's hard to find a locus of wealth inequality more obvious than New York City. But the idea that state-owned grocery stores is a sane response to that, or that we're going to get rid of billionaires, or what the other crazy Marxist things he's proposed, those aren't serious proposals. I mean, capitalism is the best we've got. What we don't want to add to capitalism is an oligarchic, winner-take-all, regressive tax code, and just obvious, you know, crony capitalism and corruption, right? Where everyone is just ransacking the place, and we have something like a kleptocracy. We want the best version of capitalism we can achieve, and that requires compassion. It requires a commitment to the common good. It requires not, you know, malignantly selfish people running the government who are trading stocks based on insider information and creating, you know, favored deals for their friends. I mean, it's just we have a layer of corruption on top of capitalism, which is giving capitalism a bad name.
Right, but we keep saying we have to address that. We have to fix it. And if anything, it's moving in the opposite direction, especially with this latest term. And so it does give rise to a Mamdani type who is incredibly likable. You know, gregarious. He's out there, you know, with the bullhorn, and he's really whipping everyone into a frenzy. And you look at the faces, and they really seem like there's some relief out there. But he's obviously selling a system that's not going to work.
Yeah, well, he's gonna freeze rents in New York City. Does that sound like a good plan to anyone who knows anything about what rent control does to the economy of a city?
Yeah, of course. But a lot of them are just saying, okay, but whatever you keep saying about capitalism, you know, I've studied it. Sounds great. It does sound better. You know, I've read the book, Sam, but you keep talking about fixing capitalism for me. It's not working. And now we got a president who's, you know, offering his friends all the deals and, you know, the insider stock trading and whatever else that you're claiming. It's going the wrong direction.
That's awful. But people are also just confused. This is another optical illusion, right? I mean, people don't recognize that even the barely middle-class people in our society today live much better than the wealthiest people on earth, you know, some years ago, right? I mean, it's just to take an extreme example. Like, I was just on a family vacation, and we went to Versailles, and you go into Versailles. Versailles is, you know, gorgeous palace outside of Paris. It's where, you know, Louis XIV, XV, and XVI lived. You look at these guys' bedrooms, right? These are the richest people in the world. This is the most opulent circumstance any human being was in the 18th century. You look at their bedrooms, right? I mean, these are, you know, everything is covered with gold, but it still sucks, right? I mean, these are not the nice places to live, right? This is just, these people were like, you know, they didn't have, you know, plumbing, right? They were shitting in their stairwells and having their servants pick it up, right? I mean, This is not a life that might be too bad. that anyone should envy, right? And so people ignore the progress we've made. Everyone's walking around with a $1,000 supercomputer in their pocket or a $400 supercomputer in their pocket, you know, and they have access to the totality of human knowledge, right? Now, obviously, I'm worried about where this is all headed, you know, with AI, et cetera. But we have to honestly take stock of what capitalism has built for us. I mean, we don't know of a better engine of wealth creation than capitalism in a democracy, right? It's just, it hasn't been discovered yet. Now, if we discover it, great, we should switch to that. But we know that socialism ain't it, right? I mean, the best recipe we have is capitalism with a social conscience. and a safe, an increasingly generous safety net. And I mean, you can call that socialism light, fine, but it's we should recognize that we don't want, the market can't see everything we care about. And we don't want trillionaires on the one hand and people dying on our sidewalks of starvation, right? So we need to figure out how to avoid the absolute extremes of wealth inequality. But any sane person should understand that, right? And the fact that we've got a lot of people at the upper echelons of wealth at the moment who don't seem to believe that they have much stock in maintaining a connection to the public good because they can, you know, jump on their Gulf Streams and escape to New Zealand, you know, that's a psychological and social problem with some of the wealthiest people in our society. But there should be reputational damage associated with that. It should be more and more embarrassing to be a person like that. And the brand damage should matter. And you know, people can boycott companies, et cetera. I mean, it shouldn't be illegal to be an asshole, but it should be consequential to be one.
Yeah, but I still think these are the people that won the lottery in some forms. You would think they're the most invested. They should be most invested in keeping the world the best place possible.
Absolutely.
If you're one of these wealthy people, you should figure out a way to get all the richest people in the world together and say, hey, okay, let's meet together once a year and figure out how to address as many of these problems as possible so that we can maintain our wonderful, the quality of life. We can still jump around on planes and yachts and no one will begrudge them. They can have big, lavish weddings and people should leave them alone and celebrate them, provided they are, but again, they have the most. The pitchforks at the gates, the security is going to flip on them at some point if we don't solve that. And you're right. I mean, we have solved many problems in this country that, you know, it's not as bad as it is in other parts of the world, but there is still a lot more to solve. So with that, I want to move to another topic, which is speaking of so much bad news and what often feels like we're hurtling toward the precipice with fears around global wars, nuclear annihilation, the higher than comfortable percentage chance that AI does just kill us all in a couple of years. And more, how do you balance staying informed with staying calm? How can we, in one moment, imagine catastrophe and then the next laugh over a couple of drinks? How do you manage your anxiety?
Well, I mean, you have one life, right? And you presumably want to be happy, right? You want to have a high level of personal well-being, and the mechanics of maintaining that is really something you can take responsibility for. I mean, you can notice that how you use your attention, I mean, you know, quite literally what you think about and what you notice from moment to moment dictates the quality of your inner life and the quality of everything you bring to each moment in your life, in the world, I mean, to your relationships, et cetera. So, you know, given that it has always been true that the world has offered enough chaos to worry about it full time, right? You have a decision to make. I mean, the world has never been a place of safety and order looked at globally, right? Insofar as people have always had information about it, there's always been something you could pay attention to that was worth worrying about, whether it's the spread of some epidemic or the possibility of injury and death that can't be corrected for, or you know, the idea that some neighboring army may come over the hill and invade you and destroy your life, right? I
mean, or any infection before we had antibiotics.
Yeah, it's always been, there's always been risk, right? And there's always been a guarantee of death, right? So like that's the context. And so all of the details of the present, the details change, but the general message for me is the same. I mean, it's just, we've always been living, we have this moment in the sun. There's storm clouds everywhere, but there's this moment where the clouds part and there's sunlight and it's beautiful. And that's your life. That's your opportunity to contribute something useful and enjoyable to this circumstance. And you can't do that if you're miserable. There's no ethical burden to be miserable, right? Like you want to be effective, you want to be engaged, you want to be helpful, but you don't want to be miserable, right? So you're just going to bring your misery into the world if that's the case. So in my experience, you can pay attention to bad things without being unhappy, right? Without being grossly unhappy. You can be concerned without being morbid.
Yeah, I liked how you addressed it when you were talking to Scott Galloway. One of the things you said was in his latest podcast, which I thought was great. The two of you were great together. When you said something about getting those signals. So if you need to be bummed out about something or you need to pay attention to something or something happens, use that information for as long as it's necessary, and then
right.
you don't need it anymore.
Yeah, you don't need the emotional reaction anymore. Like the emotion of outrage or fear or anxiety is giving you information about the world and perhaps your place in the world and perhaps real risk that needs to be responded to. But the response is almost never best done in one of those states of mind. So you can just toss the emotion once it's no longer useful, provided you can actually work with the mechanics by which that emotion arises in your mind in the first place. I mean, this is why I'm such a booster about meditation and related kind of mental hygiene, you know, leaving meditation aside, which is like cognitive reframing of your circumstance, right? This is more of a stoical device, right? But just realizing that whatever the challenge is today, whatever the disorder in your life or the world is at this moment, however it appears, just imagine that you had died yesterday, right? And lost everything. Yesterday was your last day. None of your ambition, whatever is left on your to-do list was never going to be realized. You know, the last thing you said to your friends and family was the last thing you're ever going to say, right? But now imagine you get a second chance. You're reborn into this moment, right? Now you get this extra slice of life to live from this moment forward. How grateful would you be to be able to just engage the challenges that are confronting you today? Most of us would be extraordinarily grateful to get that sense to just the opportunity to reboot and live out whatever this next chapter is, difficulties and all. And that's just an idea you can use to leverage your state of mind.
I do think we have to come back and talk about meditation at some point, because I, for one, mm-hmm. for a long time, always just thought it was sort of one of your blind spots with meditation. But with so many people in our audience today paying attention, nutrition, physical exercise, sleep, it really is the piece of the puzzle there that I think if people understood what it was, I mean, so many people will say to me, oh, I can't pay attention. I mean, I hated what I thought meditation was. I wanted nothing to do with it, as you recall. I do think at some point we're going to have to chip away, maybe on a future episode. And
well, I mean, just briefly, that the real misperception is that meditation is ultimately a practice or something you do in addition to all the other things you do. And that's just not true. It's something you cease to do. It's non-distraction.
But when you talk like that, I have no idea what that, the uninitiated doesn't get that, but you're right. It's exactly right. But people who don't know think, oh, what do you mean? You don't do anything. Or what does it mean? People will say, I can't sit still or whatever the understanding. It's really just learning how to, most people can't pay attention. Most people don't know that there's this tractor beam pulling their phone at them at all times. And when they're doing it, they're not even aware. I mean, I'm not even aware most of the time. How many people can go to the bathroom without taking their phone? Just sitting down and just it naturally comes out of the pocket. I'm not saying don't do that, but the ability to notice that and to be able to have a choice is really what meditation is. And now when I mention it, meditation in the bathroom, people are like, what are you talking about? Anyway, we'll talk about that more. It's now time for everybody's favorite segment of the show, the lightning round.
Is this really true? Has anyone said they like this segment of the show?
I haven't seen one person say it. Okay.
We'll persist until the mob stops us.
Sam, why you gotta ruin that for me? Yeah. Not one. I mean, literally not one person has said they like it, but I like it. It's my favorite part because I get less than 30-minute answers from you.
Yeah.
All right. Will there be more podcasts with Ricky Gervais?
I have no idea. I love Ricky. It's always great to talk to him. So I certainly wouldn't say no, but there's no plans.
I think what we should do is launch that festival show idea that we talked about in the past, that the pairing of traditional philosophers with comedic philosophers so that people can hear you guys go out and talk about smart things and laugh at the same time. Imagine you and Ricky headlining and you got Bill Burr and Chappelle coupled with other traditional philosophers where people could be out there and learning and having a good time. I think that would be
fun. That does not sound bad, but all right, you go do that and let me know when to show up.
And then we'd have to add Nikki Glaser, since she's hilarious and we love her.
She's hilarious.
So we'll find a way to get her in there. Maybe she'll have a good idea. Any favorite fictional books or favorite movies? Two different questions. Did you have a book when you were growing up, like a fictional book? Or
I'm trying to remember the last fiction I read. I know I read something not that long ago, but I'm blanking on it. I cannot remember the last novel I read, but it wasn't that long ago. And yeah, this is brain damage. This is proof that we're now cyborgs. I would have to go to my computer to figure out what I last read, but I might have to go to my Amazon order list to see what I last read of that was fiction. But the ratio of nonfiction to fiction is very high. I mean, I'm probably 50 to 1 nonfiction to fiction. I'm reading a great nonfiction book right now, which has been around for a long time, and many people have read it, but it escaped me. The Face of Battle by John Keegan, and it's very, very entertaining and also just very erudite and worth reading.
Yeah, note to self, buy that book and read it in 15 years when your kids are fully grown. Not going to get to it. Do you think that the reason why your memory is such is that it's probably not a senior moment? It's probably that we just outsource so much of our thinking or our memories to these devices that you just write something down or you have an experience. Or I mean, maybe not, this is not an example, perhaps with the book that you can't remember, but I do find myself taking in so many memories in a fragmented way, either because I'm behind the phone or recording it, or I'm not fully present, which I probably shouldn't admit to you, but and maybe it's that the memories are made in a deformed way versus my recall sucking. I don't know. Have you any thoughts on that?
Some of it is just context. I mean, like for me to search by the category of fiction is just like my brain is not doing that at the moment. But yeah, I mean, there's no question in my memory. There has to be a age-related component to this. I mean, memory is very unlikely to be getting better as you age, right? So like any failure of memory is at least being made more probable by the passage of time. But
you don't think it's just what plays a role, I think, is the half onboarding of an experience. So sometimes I'm not fully engaged. And if I'm not fully engaged, if I'm fully present, I usually remember things with the same.
But now with most books, like I've stopped reading on Kindles. And so this is a genuine issue with audiobooks and was an issue with Kindle for me, because you never see the cover of the book again, right? So you interact with this thing for as long as it takes to consume it. But you're like with a physical book, you're constantly seeing the cover. You're picking it up. You're having that experience of opening it. With reading on a Kindle or listening to an audiobook, I've consumed books where I forgot the author's name, right? Because it's just, I never saw it again. And I consume so many books in so many different formats that when I care now, I'm tending to read a physical book. So
it's a better experience. I mean, it's not a better experience in terms of functionality, but I just like to hold the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Something about it.
And it's also a better way of reclaiming, it's a way of reclaiming your attention in the current context. I mean, we're so fragmented by the way we're using our phones and our computers. And just when you're using your phone or your computer to read, whether it's articles or books or you're listening to audio, you're obviously susceptible to interruption on both those platforms in a way that you're not with a book. I mean, it's just to put down the devices and read a physical book is almost a revolutionary act now. I mean, it's embarrassing to say it, but it's just there's so few people can manage it for hours at a stretch. I mean, I know many people who discover or rediscover the ability to do this when they're on an airplane. Well, you're on an airplane, it doesn't have Wi-Fi, now you've got a book in your hands, and for the first time in God knows how long, you're actually reading for hours, right? And there's something, I'm mortified by that when I have that experience, but that caused me to now more or less ditch Kindle as a way of reading. And I still love audio because it allows you to take a walk and also listen to a book or listen to a podcast, but that strikes me as different.
Thanks for that quick answer.
And
now quickly for your favorite movies, anything, any favorite movies? Quickly.
Favorite movie going all the way back in time or?
I don't know. That's the question. I don't know. One back then, one now.
Well, listen, I love watching and rediscovering movies with my daughters. I've been watching with our youngest. She and I have been watching Hitchcock films, which has been fantastic. I mean, for some reason, she's into Hitchcock, but she's 11 and she finds like the movies I would have been sure would have thrilled her, like Raiders of the Lost Ark. 7 minutes in with a giant boulder rolling down and chasing Harrison Ford out of a cave. She's bored to tears and wants to just switch off the television, but she'll watch Vertigo for the fifth time with me. So it's bizarre.
It's probably because that special effect was so cool when it was done, and
it's totally fine. I don't know what's wrong with Raiders of the Lost Ark, but anyway, it's fun to watch those films with her. With my oldest, we just watched The Godfather for the first time, and talk about a film that still holds up. It's fantastic. So
What do you think of a possibility of a common sense third party?
A common sense, is this an oblique reference to what Elon's up to, or is it because it's not going to be common sense in that party if he starts it?
Well, speaking of that, if Elon called you and asked you for a list of some part,
yeah.
Hold on, let me finish. If he didn't,
no, the answer is no for the call. I don't think there's anything to talk about.
If he called me and he said, "Hey, Jaron, listen, can you ask Sam for a list of some party cornerstones? What might some of those be? Like, just these are some basic."
Well, the irony is we would agree about some of them, right? It's just he's a maniac, so he can't be in charge of anything. But no, I mean, like the fact that he's worried about the debt, that makes total sense, right? Like some kind of economic rectitude in a party would be a good idea. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a commitment to the common good and mitigating the problems of wealth inequality, both here and abroad, that I think would escape him and would be a priority for me. I mean, obviously we need growth, but we need growth that's not sociopathic in its disparities in outcome.
Let's go back to the question you thought I was going to ask you, because this is more realistic. Andrew Yang's a friend of ours. What if he reached out? He seems to be wanting to work with Elon. He said, "Look, Sam, I'll manage Elon on my side, but you're a fan of mine, and you know I've been trying to develop this third party for a long time.
Right?
Would you join the team in that formation, or still no way?"
I honestly don't know enough about the details to know how quixotic or insane launching a third party is. There are many people who think even with Elon's resources, there's just no way he's going to successfully launch a third party.
Well, do you think we need one in general? Do you think we need a third party or a two-party fine?
I mean, in the abstract, it sounds like a good idea. I think we pay a price for having just these two parties that are functioning as gatekeepers of a sort that clearly haven't served us in recent years. I mean, the capture of the Republican Party by Trumpism has been, you know, patently insane. And so it's not even a normal political party anymore. It really is a personality cult. So there's a problem there to be fixed. I mean, I don't know how you fix the Republican Party. Post-Trump, maybe it just kind of naturally morphs back into some recognizable shape. I don't know. And everyone pretends that they didn't throw out all their principles in the previous decade. But yeah, the Democratic Party there's a lot to despair about. It's mechanics. It's the people who don't have a prayer of being elected, given the way it's captured by the kind of coalitional structure of far left lunatics. So yeah, it's very tempting to say, "Oh, you've got unlimited resources, start a third party." But people who know much more about the mechanics of instantiating that in, you know, 50 states have said this is very unlikely to bear fruit, even with his resources. So I honestly don't know.
The Dems got nuked last year, and I don't know that they've made any progress. So maybe he'll find his way back to the Democrats.
Well, they're not making progress if Mamdani is a bellwether.
No. What does a typical day in the life of Sam Harris look like? And I added this part: is lying okay here to make the answer less boring?
Yeah, no.
I think people like us just don't have typical days. I don't know how you.
No, I don't have typical days, really. I mean, some days I'm writing, some days I'm reading, some days I'm talking. I mean, they're just, there's a lot of consumption of information. Again, audio has got, I'm not telling anyone it's something they don't know here, but for me, it's just audio has uncovered at least 2 extra hours in my day where I can listen to something good. And so in the absence of that, to be stuck at a screen or to be stuck with a book in your hands is synonymous with being, you know, more sedentary than I want to be, or, you know, more anchored to being alone in a room than I want to be. Yeah, I mean, I'm an information junkie, probably to a fault, but where that finds me is there's no standard practice.
Last question. We're a little over halfway through the year. How's your New Year's resolution going?
Yeah, well, I've been blown around by events. I mean, I made that resolution, obviously, before I was going to live through the fires in LA and all of the hassle that I incurred from that. I mean, I think I've been pretty good. I mean, the resolution was to live this year as though it were my last, right? In terms of my prioritizing, you know, what I, you know, how I would pay attention to things and act so as to feel no regrets about how I use that time. I would give myself a B plus in how I've done that. I mean, it's actually been pretty good, even with all of the weirdness of the last 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes those disruptions, I mean, it's probably, you know, stoic in nature, can force you to really pay attention differently to things.
Yeah.
And to maybe appreciate things that you wouldn't otherwise have had the chance to do. So.
Yeah. I have six more months to improve, but, you know, it hasn't been bad. It's strange to say it, but it's actually been a good 6 months, even though I would not have, if you list the things that have happened and the things I've had to do in response to those happenings, I would have not picked most of what has been, you know, on the menu.
Well, Sam, I'm going to go ahead and, I'm going to give you an A- for this year.
Okay.
I think you've done great.
Well, thank you for that.
And with that, that is time for the show. I want to thank everyone who's submitted topics and comments. If you'd like to help with this show in the future, you'll need to subscribe over at samharris.org, and that subscription will automatically unlock a paid account over at Substack, where you can submit questions and participate in the online community. Thank you, Sam, for letting me do this with you. It's always an honor, and yeah. I know so many in the audience appreciate it. And so until next time, my friend, thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, everybody. I'm not sure how I set this next clip up, but if you stuck around here, we got to talking with our producer, Griffin, and he wanted us to cover a subject that we didn't get on this episode. So we got to talking and we hit record. And what you're about to watch next is that subject, that topic that didn't make it. And I don't know how many of you remember CDs back in the day. CDs used to have, they were longer than albums, so you could have a hidden track. So think of this as a hidden track at the end of the CD where you only had 10 tracks. And then, oh my God, you were surprised by 11th track. So this is the 11th track, and we're about to play it now. Enjoy.
Okay.
All right. We got to talking about this after we had ended the episode. So I just wanted to quickly make this an addendum. Griffin, please share your concerns. Come on, hit us with it.
Okay. So, well, Jaron, you were saying, why don't these people who, you know, they think that Sam is so wrong on Israel, why don't they just leave? Why do they feel like they need to agree with him on everything? You know, either they should just accept it or they
I didn't say they should leave. I said they should just leave it alone. My argument was, it's
right,
okay. My whole position, I wasn't saying that. I said, at some point, you're just going to have to accept that Sam's an idiot on this, or they're an idiot, or everyone's an idiot, or no one's an idiot, but we're not going to agree here. We just have to let it go and move on. That was my position. Isn't it possible? And then I added to say, people show up to Sam's audience all the time for the process, just as much as the outcome. And so maybe they don't agree with him on this issue, but it's worth paying attention to how he arrives at his answers. But so many people seem to not be able to let this go. Then you jumped in and said,
right. Okay. I'm just saying, if these people genuinely believe, which a lot of them do, that Israel is committing a genocide, that's something that's so bad that it's, you can't just look past it. But they don't want to give up on Sam because they view Sam as, you know, they look up to Sam. They, you know, maybe they've been influenced by him and his thinking. And so they want him to get it, right? But they're so frustrated that they feel like you're not getting it. And I think that the reason that they won't leave is because they haven't actually heard you, Sam, directly engage with someone who shares their beliefs. And if they did, they could either then sort of be like, okay, you know what? He was right. I heard him debate someone and everything he was saying made sense to me. And, you know, it finally clicked. Or, you know, he was kind of tested and I don't think he passed the test. And, you know,
I'm out of here.
I'm abandoning ship. And I think that that's where so many people are caught up because they're like, you're not getting it, but I don't want to leave yet. I'm still invested, you know, and I was, the comparison was like, if you have a family member who believes some crazy conspiracy that's, you know, super concerning, you don't want to just fucking tell them to, you know, leave.
Right.
You're like, shaking them, like, please let me help you understand.
Right. Well, so the fact that they haven't given up hope for me suggests to me that they don't actually think that I'm a fan of genocide. Right. If they thought I was a fan of genocide, they should give up on me. Right. Like they should just, there are other people who are smart and interesting. Presumably they thought I was until I became a supporter of genocide. They should just move on. Right. I mean, like, if you flip it around and you imagine that I was supporting Hamas, right. Just, and I just came out and said, yes, I'm, you know, I think Hamas is There's some righteous freedom fighters. They had to do what they did on October 7th. I'm all in for that. You know, I just think that killing the babies was good and kidnapping the other babies was good and the old ladies. And, you know, I'm with those crowds that were just dancing for joy in the streets and spitting on the dead and dying hostages. I'm in for all that. That's me. That's my worldview. I'm feeling that. That's the vibe I like, right? If I were that, people should jump ship, right? That's my brain is broken. So assuming that they think my brain is analogously broken in the other direction, right, by supporting a genocide of the innocent Palestinian people, the pointless killing of tens of thousands of people and the attempt to kill, I mean, obviously genocide, the word has a meaning. It's not, does not map onto what's actually happening and happened in Gaza, but let's just say they think it does. If they think I'm for that, I don't see why they're wasting any time trying to rehabilitate my image in their mind. That's a deal breaker.
Okay, so first of all, I mean, I still think we can break it into two categories, but I think that there are probably people who feel that way, who do think that it's a genocide and still want you to come around on it. And I'll get to that one in a sec. But the other one is probably the larger camp is those who think it's not a genocide, but it's almost looking like a genocide. And, you know, almost feels like you get into that territory, but Israel is probably committing war crimes and they've gone about this war in a horrible way. And you're not putting enough emphasis on, you know, the insane government and the religious fanatics who are driving this war and into who knows where, right? Like what's the end game? We don't really know. There's no plan for the day after. And in the meantime, tons and tons of civilians just keep dying. And it's Israel's fault. And so they might feel like that, where it's like, okay, like Sam, I want to see where you're coming from, but like, I just feel like you're not fully engaging with this over here. Can we just try? Like, I really want you to see it. Now, with the people who, I mean, I understand what you're saying, with the people who, you know, really believe it's a genocide, like, why don't they should just leave? But even still, I mean, I would still come back to, like, if these are people who feel like you influence their thinking so much over the years that it's almost equivalent to, you know, having a family member who's, you know, again, who's just, right, is massively wrong on something, you still don't want to just tell them, go fuck yourself. You really want to help them understand. And I think in both of those camps, there are a lot of people who just want, they can't give up hope that, you know, you'll come around and see at least a little bit of the other side.
Right.
And I think that a lot of these people would either feel satisfied or, you know, be like, okay, that's enough, I'm done. If they heard you, you know, hop on with Thomas Friedman or Ezra Klein or whoever and sort of just get into it, and maybe it wouldn't be productive, but it might show people, honestly, that, you know, maybe that's what people need to see. Maybe like, oh, you know what? That was totally unproductive. And, you know, I'm giving up here and I'm just going to have to come to my own conclusions. And either, you know, I'm giving up on Sam or, you know, I'm sort of coming around. But
well, before Sam jumps in, I mean, where you changed my mind on this, where I think is that I just thought this needs to just be, we can't keep having this conversation again and again. But I like the reason I like Sam having a conversation with Jordan Peterson was not to persuade him, but that there are many in the audience whose minds are up for grabs or maybe whose minds could be changed. Mm. And so when you said that, I thought, okay, maybe it's worth talking to somebody, even if they're going to be locked out. You know, Sam and whoever he talks to will not move from their positions at all. It may be helpful to those in the audience, as you said, Griffin, to hear them have this conversation. I don't know. I'm open to that for sure. Sam, what do you think?
Well, there are things that can be debated and there are things which I think are just absolutely a waste of time to debate, right? And so, yes, I don't know how Israel should defeat Hamas and make it so that they never have to deal with Hamas ever again. But that is a worthy goal, right? And the Palestinians need to be convinced that that's a worthy goal, right? I mean, all of this destruction has been brought to them because of what Hamas did on October 7th. And they have to be convinced of that, right? And the Muslim world generally has to be convinced of that with respect to jihadist organizations that spring up here and there in whatever country, right? So everyone who's adjacent to Al-Qaeda, wherever it still exists, or Al-Shabaab, or Boko Haram, or Lashkar-e-Taiba, or I mean, just pick your flavor of lunatic, right? these are organizations that have to be crushed because we're effectively in a zombie movie with these specific groups of people. The Muslim world, 2 billion people have to wake up to this fact. I mean, no one's being harmed more than Muslims by jihadists. I mean, that's the irony here is that they just...
Yeah, but Sam, can you not have this conversation with a Thomas Friedman or somebody else instead of us? You know, is it possible? Why can't you have this conversation with...
Well, I could, but the thing that's not... What I always find myself debating with secular people who just don't understand the jihadist mindset, don't want to understand the jihadist mindset, is whether jihadists really believe what they say they believe, right? People just suspect that if we could only respond to their political demands, insofar as they have any, or economic inequalities, or something, nationalist, you know, pride, or they're always trying to translate the jihadist project into something that they're familiar with, that most human beings care about. But that's not what the jihadist project is. The jihadist project is a death cult. It really, and it's sincerely embraced by the people who consider themselves jihadists. So if you're not going to admit that, I'm just going to spin my wheels for an hour trying to get you to admit that. And
don't you think there are people who would, I mean, you mentioned this in, you know, in your Substack piece, but there are people who admit that, you know, yes, jihadists are, you know, members of a death cult, but the Palestinian people have legitimate political grievances. And
yeah. I've never denied that. I would never deny that. And I would say, I can check every other box you want me to check. Yes, the religious fanatics on the Israeli side are bad and distracting and causing harm. And if there were more of them, it would be worse, and it could get worse and worse and worse, and it could get so bad that the two sides would be indistinguishable in this conflict. And then I would throw up my hands and say, I don't care who wins, right? But they're nowhere near as dominant a force on the Israeli side as they are on the Palestinian side, right? I mean, it's like most Israelis are not embracing the worldview of the ultra-Orthodox or, you know.
It seems like a lot are, though. I mean, I keep seeing, you know, every time you say that, I see a lot of comments that come in with
yeah, but that's a scale issue. There's still the asymmetry, the scale issue. So even if you have some percentage points, it's still not the same on both sides. But I just want to say, where's Graham Wood on this? I mean, obviously he understands jihadists. Is he somewhere in between? Is he on your side, or is he between you and Thomas? Or maybe he could be a part of it.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen Graham publish recently on this. Perhaps I missed it. But no, I mean, Graham totally has his head screwed on straight around jihadism. He knows that these people really have the courage of their convictions, and he knows how problematic the theology is. And he's, as far as I know, there's no daylight between us on this topic.
What about Josh Zepps?
Well, Josh is, I think, much more concerned about the corruption or apparent corruption of Netanyahu and capture by the right wing in Israeli politics. I mean, he's much more concerned about the optics of all of this. I mean, that's even the wrong way to put it. I'm also concerned. I just think the onus is still on the moral confusion of the left around jihadism, and also the latent anti-Semitism that is swirling around the place, you know, in all directions at all times.
Well, Griffin and I will think about it. We'll put a list together. I mean, we're all obviously big fans of Josh Zepps over here, and I don't know if he's the right person for it or not. I mean, I know that he had released or put an article out that got a lot of attention that people seem to like. I actually hadn't read it yet, but I had plans to read it. And then Graham Wood, I know you have a great relationship with. I wonder if we put together a panel of sorts, or maybe a three-way conversation with you, Graham, and, you know, a Thomas Friedman or similar, or someone on the other side, where they understand the claims that you're making or your larger concerns, might be worth having that conversation for the audience.
So what the audience wants to hear is that a sufficient number of dead babies is unacceptable, no matter, and trumps any other concern, right? And yes, at a certain point, even I would sign on the dotted line, right? I'm not saying that Israel should kill a million people in order to solve the Hamas problem, right? So it's just people have drawn that line in a different place. They've said, okay, Israel has already killed too many people. I mean, so to be clear, most of the people we're talking about drew that line before Israel killed anybody, right? Most of the people started castigating Israel on October 8th, right? The morons at Harvard in the, whatever it was, 32 student organizations who signed, you know, protest letters against Israel on October 8th, these people, it wasn't about body count, right? They were already just, they had their mouths full of blood libels against Israel immediately, right? So that was anti-Semitism. That was the capture of libtard dummies by Islamists. That was as awful. I mean, it's impossible to exaggerate how awful and stupid and ultimately suicidal for the West that attitude is if you brought it to scale, right? These people who would just, you know, wear, you know, rainbow-colored hijabs in the Women's March and not knowing anything about the real implications for women's rights the world over for any of that. So,
all right, we got it. Let's save it for the ring. Okay. We're going to find somebody for you. We'll have that conversation.
But the point is, the it's an understandable moral intuition that, okay, if Israel has killed too many people, right, an unjustifiable number of non-combatants, whatever the threat posed by Hamas, yes, there's a lie. I think everyone has to admit that there's some line there that if you crossed it, everyone would object, including me, right? So one way of framing this grievance is my tolerance for the deaths of non-combatants in this particular war is far too great, right? And I should have been 1,000 non-combatants was the limit, right? And like trusting Hamas's figures about how many non-combatants have died, at a certain point we crossed it over into just pure evil, right? Whatever the justification. Again, when you hold this up against other wars, you just can't, like, war is awful. War in a very crowded place, fighting an insurgency, especially a suicidal, genocidal insurgency that considers the deaths of its own civilians to be a propaganda victory, that's guaranteed to be awful. And its awfulness is magnified by the nature of the enemy that Israel is fighting.
Well, Sam, listen, I'm with you on all this. Griffin's with you on some of it, but we both agree that I think it would be great to talk to somebody on the other side if it's not just you spinning your wheels. So I think we should leave it here.
Again, it would have to be someone who understands jihadism, and that. But if you filter by that, you lose 95% of people who would be put forward as.
We're gonna have to find someone candidates. We'll have to find someone in that 5%.
Yeah. All right. I'm down for it.
We'll figure it out. No question. All right, everybody. Thanks again for sticking around for this hidden track.